So the last thing I need from you before we stop recording is to record the bumper where you just say, hi, my name is blank and my favorite thing is blank. But you fill in the blanks.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones. And this is the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things and we get recommendations without using an algorithm. It is Saturday the 18th. This podcast will be going out both on time and a week late. As you already heard from the intro, we're missing our usual bumper. This week I have Cameron McKenzie on. He's an author. His new book, River Weather Stories, launched a couple weeks ago, and this episode was meant to coincide with his book release. Unfortunately, I switched from using Zoom as my recording software to something called Riverside, and our audio was filled with problems, and we had this amazing conversation, and random phrases from his, like random 2 to 6 second bits of his side of the interview got doubled and tripled, but nothing on my interview got doubled. So editing this interview was very difficult. And now that I'm 6 weeks into chemotherapy, I just simply have less time and energy for doing complicated mental tasks. So this episode had to sit for a week while I thought about literally how to do the math of making this work. So I believe I've pulled together as best as I can this episode with author Cameron McKenzie. In my, you know, personal life updates, like I said, this week marked the halfway point of my chemotherapy. If you're new to the podcast, this summer I was diagnosed with breast cancer. All known breast cancer is out of my body after a successful surgery and lymph node biopsy, but I'm doing chemotherapy. So I'm halfway through my treatment of Taxol, which means like, so I've losing my hair. My taste buds are kind of getting hollowed out in a weird way. Like bland, the circle of what is bland is increasing for me. And that is very strange. I did go back today to Pilates. I take one-on-one lessons or training at a studio down the road from my here. And I love Pilates as one of the exercises I've found as an adult that I love the most. I love the stretches of it. And I love the small concentrated movements that really engage your core muscles and your hip flexors. And so I have some kind of euphoria from doing Pilates again. And I actually had expected to be totally exhausted, and I'm not. So that feels really good. In this, you know, cancer treatment that I'm in, you know, the chemo's just the first 12 weeks of the treatment. I have a parallel year of antibody treatment. So once the chemo ends, then I do radiation. At some point I get a CPAP machine, so I'll get some better sleep. It's really been a lot of just showing up for appointments. I have had people really say they're really impressed by my attitude in this. I just have a very much like, I show up for the meetings. I do what I stay hydrated. I put Aquaphor in my nose before I go to bed so I don't get bloody noses because the Taxol really dries you out. I just heard today that maybe Claritin helps every day because it helps with inflammation that Taxol starts. I'm starting to get my chemo farts under control. I don't remember if I've been on the podcast since I talked about that. But a friend in the dose cord last night said, well, chemo is essentially like exfoliating your GI tract. It's really messing with my gut flora. I'm really trying to take it easier on dairy because chemo farting has turned me into Beavis and Butthead, both of them. I am disgusting. And I'm talking about it because nobody does. How is it that nobody talks about, you know, cancer, man? It's so dumb. It's like the most generic diagnosis. I think that's the other thing I've learned, that to say you have a breast cancer diagnosis is to say practically nothing. It's like in a movie when somebody walks up to the counter and is like, "Hey, bartender, I'll have a beer." Well, what does that mean? Like, when I say I was diagnosed with breast cancer, it doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't tell you what type of cell it started in, the genetic makeup of it. You know, do I have BRCA? Is it triple negative, triple positive? In my case, it's positive, negative, positive. There's just like all this stuff. And breast cancer, I realize, is just generic. And you have to get more and more specific of finding the people with similar diagnoses and treatment plans to you to get advice that is useful. So that's been kind of wild. My thank you pens came in that I got to give to people that say, "Today's hospital husband." You know, it is a problem with our society that the assumption is any man who would accompany me to the hospital is my husband, and that any woman that goes with me to the hospital, she does not become my wife. But I had these really lovely enamel pens say, made for friends, that say "Today's hospital husband" on one side, on the public side, with a little hashtag "fuck cancer" on the back, to say thank you to friends who are in family, who are bringing me meals and keeping me company and helping me clean the litter box and fill the ice trays and go to the store. And as I get into the second half of chemo, I'm saying yes to a lot more help, which has been very hard for me to do. I'm a very independent, stubborn, stoic Aries, and to accept all the help that has been given to me and accept the love that has been shown to me is very hard to do, but I'm very grateful for the friends teaching me this lesson in this time of my life. In January right now, the plan, I've got one more episode banked and one more interview that I need to reschedule. And then in January, I've asked my friends, Shai Corman from Friday Night Movie Podcast and Amy Guth from Crane's Daily Gist, to take over hosting in January while I finish chemotherapy. I will add these intros to the episodes, but they're both fans of the show. They know how the interviews, they know the format of the interview. They kind of have access to different people and they know how to record and edit. So in January, Amy and Shai are going to take on guest hosting for me, which I'm very grateful. And then my plan is to come back in February, hopefully with some recordings from my, well, we'll see what Omicron does. But the carrot at the end of the stick for me, the carrot at the end of chemotherapy, are going to 3 Doughboys live shows. One in Chicago, one at Foxwoods Casino, and one in Boston. And so right now, all entertainment in New York is getting shut down, so I'm not feeling great that in late January, early February, we'll have live shows, and that I'll be getting on an airplane. But if we do, I'll be at the DoseCon, Doughboys Con, in Foxwoods Casino, and I'm going to be like Podcaster from the new Ghostbusters movie, and I'm going to take my little Zoom recorder on the floor of the casino and find my fellow domies, and we're going to talk about why we love the Doughboys live from Foxwoods. So hopefully that's what I'll come back in February, but grateful in advance for Shai and Amy agreeing to take on a few episodes for me. So without further ado, today's episode is with Cameron McKenzie. His favorite thing is dreams and dream interpretation. And please get boosted. Get that third vaccine if you're immunocompromised. Get the vaccine if you haven't yet. Wear your mask, wash your hands, and keep enjoying your favorite things. Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things and get recommendations without using an algorithm. Tonight, I am joined by Cameron McKenzie. Cameron is an author and educator based in Virginia. His new book, a series of stories called River Weather, is coming out this winter. You can pre-order it now. We'll talk a lot more about it. Cameron, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing good, Leah. It's really nice to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Is it winter yet where you are in Virginia?
It has become winter. We had sort of a false winter. It got some cold, and then it got warm again. Normally, it doesn't get this cold for another month or so, but yeah. I like the cold.
Okay.
I'm hoping this sticks.
We had, Friday was our first little flurry. I'm in Chicago.
Probably colder there.
Yeah, I think so. So I was downtown and I was looking at Lake Michigan. I was like, oh, what a beautiful view. The colors are really nice today. And then I looked out 10 minutes later and I was like, I can no longer see the lake. It has disappeared.
And that was the end of fall.
So I was reading your bio, and it's very brief, but you talk about that you were born in Virginia, and you've worked as a dry cleaner, a doorman, a house painter, farmhand. You've lived in Santa Barbara, London, Tokyo, and now you're back in Virginia again. You mentioned that you're a teacher. What brought you back to Virginia?
Oh, gosh. The price of buying a house in the Bay Area in California is really what
brought me back to Virginia. Yeah.
I was living out there, loved the Bay Area, loved everything about Northern California, but, you know, it just got to the point I wasn't working at Google or Facebook, and I didn't have Google and Facebook money.
Right.
And, yeah, I have family in Virginia, and I'd be back here for the holidays. And I would start to look at, you know, the price of homes on Zillow and laugh. Oh, that's so cute. Mm-hmm. And then slowly said, maybe that's actually a really good idea, until it became a great idea. Mm-hmm. But I'm really happy that I moved back. You know, Northern California is not necessarily what it was when I moved there 10 years ago. There's a lot of really interesting stuff happening in this part of Virginia right now.
In what part of Virginia are you? Are you like close to DC? Are you further? Like I don't know Virginia well.
Yeah. So I grew up outside of DC,
In
Northern Virginia, in Ashburn, Virginia, which was a place, you know, when I first started college, I would tell people I'm from Ashburn. They had no idea where that was. Mm-hmm. And now so many people know what was just really just an intersection 20 years ago. Is now a monstrous development that just keeps growing and growing. I'm not living in Northern Virginia now. I live in Southwest Virginia. I live in Roanoke, Virginia, which is a hip little mountain town. You know, it's a lot of fun.
Nice. There's
great biking, great hiking.
Yeah.
It's sort of an undiscovered jewel so far. We don't like to tell too many people about it.
Well, I think they think about Roanoke and then they get spooked. Right? Isn't that where the first colony was supposed to be, the first landing?
Yeah, right.
Isn't that a piece of trivia lodged in my brain?
and a good piece of trivia it is, right? It's that I guess they wrote Roanoke on a tree. So that happened at the mouth of the river, or it has a lot more to do with the river. So the Roanoke River starts up here in the mountains. And then runs all the way down.
Oh, okay.
And that's where that colony was.
Okay. So you're at a different side.
Different. The original name of this town was Big Lake.
Upriver.
Because there was a big salt lake, and when it became sort of a railroad hub, and they wanted to sound a little more fancy, they changed the name to Roanoke.
Yeah, I was just telling a story that my dad had told me that isn't true. But that I love about my hometown, that I think is just a Larry Jones original. I'm from Terre Haute, Indiana, which in French means highland. We're on the high side of the river. But he was teasing me once and telling me originally it was Tar Hut, because you would stop there and you would put tar in your wagon to ford the river. But then they had to class it up. Again, the railroads are coming yes. through and you can't be Tar Hut. And so they became Terre Haute. But considering across the river, there's a toad hop and it's still that called Toad right. Hop. It is. It's yeah. possible.
Yeah. I read something about this. Doing research for another book that I have yet to write. I sort of hit a wall with it, but
mm-hmm.
if you follow the migration of the Scotch-Irish down, they came in through Philadelphia, so many of them, and came down through the Shenandoah Valley, and you can tell where they've been based on the names of things.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's just very sort of plain, flat, sometimes vaguely obscene place names. And you can follow, mm-hmm. you know, their progress through North America based on it. Yeah.
So the Big mountains.
Lick, definitely.
Yeah. That makes sense to me. And this is your, is this your second book?
Yeah. Well, actually my third.
Or, yeah, it's your third. Great.
I wrote a book of scholarship in between the novel and this one.
That was the one about the, that was a poetry one,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. The first, first book was a novel. About the Mexican Revolution. And then I wrote, how would I describe this? It's a book of scholarship, pretty much about modernist poetry and about how a lot of those same ideas are still being talked about by contemporary philosophers. So this would be
okay.
The story collection, that'd be number three.
Great. And for River Weather, I have found it really interesting talking to authors as we're not out of COVID, but we're sort of in the thaw of the pandemic, maybe. How much of River Stories for you was pre-COVID writing? How much was COVID editing? Mm. Where does COVID fall in the creation of this book for you?
The book, most of the stories in the book, I think I started shortly after I found out that my novel is going to be published. And what that gave me was a big boost of confidence that I wasn't a crazy person sitting in a room alone for hours every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to, I think, loosen up. I'd you know, published stories before then. They're very tight. I think they're very sort of mannered. And I was able to loosen mm-hmm. up a lot once I really just had more confidence in my own writing that I could do this sort of thing. And so the stories, I think, got better. They got longer, they got more complicated, perhaps more sophisticated. And so they came out, you know, I went through a phase, I think, of writing long stories. And then I think I just sort of got burnt out by long stories, and then I started writing flash fiction. Probably a lot of the COVID stuff, during COVID, I was writing mostly flash fiction, and I think there's maybe four or five of those pieces in there. But that's been a lot of the COVID writing, the flash stuff. The editing probably has been through COVID, you know, especially when I'm putting the book out there, you know, to see who's interested in the editing process. it starts to become ongoing, and then I have to stop myself, and I say, no, the story's done. Leave the story alone. It's going to be okay.
Right. You have to, at some point, the words have to stay on the page.
Yes. Somebody has to decide the story's done.
Right.
I'm the only one that can do that.
Yeah. Is flash fiction, is it defined by a word count or by the amount of time it takes to write it? That feels like a dumb question now that I've said it out loud.
I only give myself 30 seconds. I don't know. Well, I started reading very short things. And I started liking them, and I started to think about doing them. I think, you know, the difference between flash fiction and microfiction and short shorts and, you know, all these sort of different names people want to give it, and even what it is it's supposed to do. Some people believe that it should do everything a story does. It should just do it in a page instead of 20 pages. I don't necessarily think it has to do that at all. Some people would call, you know, a piece of flash fiction poetry and not fiction. All of these labels get, they're sort of beside the point to me, you know. Some of the stuff I write, it sounds more like a story, and some of the stuff I write sounds more impressionistic. And for me, it's all sort of part of the same practice. It's just a question of length. You know, when I'm thinking about a traditional American short story, I think it has to do five or six particular things. And maybe one of the fun things for me about the flash fiction is I'm able to leave those ideas of what a story is behind.
Is it asking you to step into the classroom too much to ask you what your five or six things that define a story are? Or are you secretly a chemistry teacher?
Actually, I think a lot of the stories in this book came out, and it's sort of one of the reasons why I stopped writing these long stories. It was almost a question of once I figured out how I wanted to do it, then I began to lose interest in the form. But I would say that when I look at a story, what I was trying to do with the stories, they have to begin a particular way. I like to begin long stories sort of in the middle of something. I want to drop the reader right into a scene of action, and then try to wrap that up with the first couple pages. Then drop down. I hate exposition. I hate exposition with a white, hot, burning passion. And I'd never want to write it. I often have to go back. When I'm first writing a story, I'll try to lay down as much as I can, as quickly as I can, and sketch out different parts.
Yeah.
And so the parts I sketch out are the exposition. I despised exposition until really I think I started to read Alice Munro seriously. And once I, of course, she's a genius in everything she does, but once I saw how she could make exposition exciting and interesting and just have so much texture to it, I said, that's how you do it. Okay, all right. And that really helped me approach exposition with something other than dread. And honestly, I think probably my more successful stories are the ones where I'm enjoying the exposition as opposed to just trying to get through it as quickly as possible.
I think it makes sense that ultimately, a story would be more successful if you enjoyed writing all the parts of it.
Yes, right. No part should be torture.
Yeah.
I like stories to move. I like stories to move really quickly. I like I don't want to the lyrical parts of a story. And I try to have I love to write lyrically. I used to simply just do that, and then I realized no one knew what I was talking about. They have to have some sort of structure. You can't just begin. Again, that question of structure takes me back to, what is the story doing? Why are we, talking about, a storm cloud, for instance? We have to get to this. You have to earn that storm cloud. You know what I mean? So to try to get to those pieces, which are, to my mind, almost sort of pauses in the story, that there has to be a lot of movement towards it and then a lot of movement from it. The question of movement for me is so often a question of dialogue, which I do love to write. I could write dialogue all day long. It's not difficult for me. Exposition, incredibly difficult. Dialogue, not difficult at all. I love writing dialogue. It often goes on too long. I have to go back and then, cut half of it off, which is, sad. But yeah, we got to just keep the best parts. But yeah, dialogue into and then dialogue out of. And then it's just a question of, what else goes into a story? You have description. Exposition, description, dialogue, lyrical passages. And really, it starts to become a question of, and I think I learned this writing the novel. I learned so much writing the novel, just about how to write. The question of pacing is really maybe top two most important things for me. When are we going too fast? When are we going too slow? When do we need to speed up? When do we need to come down? When do we need a pause after what just happened? And what kind of pause are we going to have?
Right.
I don't know if that got too in the weeds.
And do you... It's not too in the weeds. It's not too in the weeds. Do you ever take your love of dialogue to playwriting or screenwriting? Or are you so far short story, flash fiction, novel focused?
I haven't tried it. I think about
it.
But I read screenplays and I say, okay, that's interesting. But I guess the screenplays that I have written, I can't think of necessarily names off the top of my head, but they seem so bare bones, really, when I look at them on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And they're built to do that.
Right.
But I would have a strong inclination to start, you know, coloring in things that I might not need to color in.
Right, that you want to do the direction
absolutely.
The dialogue.
And yeah, and that's, yeah, the idea of just just doing a third of the story, really, you know, a skeleton of a plot with people talking. I'm like, what is this? Is this a, what form is this? And, you know, it's a form that people are very successful in. But one I might have to, you know, work a little bit harder at to really nail down.
In the podcast West Wing Weekly, which was like the podcast that got me into listening to podcasts at all, they used to talk about the way that Aaron Sorkin gets exposition in is they nicknamed it Attella Donna. And if you ever watched West Wing.
I love it. Love it.
Okay. So when they're walking down the hallway explaining something to Donna, that was exposition. And that was Attella Donna. And that was Aaron Sorkin like trying to like explain the legislature or like where the politics are at or the details. Would be a walk and talk with Donna and Attella Donna.
Yes. When I was, I totally get that. When I was finishing up grad school and I was just in my house all day long trying to write a dissertation, I would constantly play either The West Wing or Deadwood. And not many people remember Deadwood.
Ooh.
But the writing in Deadwood was just so gorgeous. And the way that exposition got done in Deadwood was they would give it to the number one character, who was Al Swearengen. And he was by far the most dynamic actor. And he was usually shouting it at someone while he was drinking whiskey. So you would miss it often. But based on the Byzantine nature of that show, you didn't. I mean, it's kind of beside the point. But if you go back, it was there. The tough thing about The West Wing, for sure, and I think listening to so much Aaron Sorkin dialogue from simply going through all the West Wing seasons as many times as I did, really sort of soaked into my, you know, lizard brain as to how dialogue should be written. And so, sometimes I find myself doing, I'm like, where does that come from? I'm like, oh, that's just, I got that from Sorkin. Maybe I should, you know, de-Sorkinize that a little bit. But he's an absolute, I love the setups, you know, where you've got the president behind the desk, right? And you have somebody who thinks they're smart, but they're not smart, and they come in, and then they have this conversation where the president just breaks down the person who thinks they're smart. And then you have a secretary wander in and out, and it's just wonderful. It's the same setup in The Social Network, I think, when one of the characters goes to visit the president of Harvard. It's a West Wing scene.
Yeah.
The president's behind the desk. The secretary walks in and walks in. It's great. Yeah. Very Sorkin.
There's a couple supercut videos that Kevin T. Porter made that are of like Sorkinisms of his favorite names and phrases and things that have come up in like Sports Night, West Wing, American President, right? The things that he uses, reuses and recycles and plot points and stuff. But I don't know if you got a tool of boxes and it's works well for you. It's okay to keep
like,
using them,
every
I think.
Why does character need to give their resume?
Right.
He loves that.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I watch something written by Sorkin now, you know, Sorkin feels like family to me, and I'm willing to, you know, find his faults just endearing.
Yeah, I think him and like Amy Sherman Palladino, those writers for whom there's no improvising on set, like every word is on the screen, and they're so careful with the words they choose, and every word is important, and they just want their actors to say the words. Like, I wrote them for a reason. Say the words I gave you. It's one of the things I enjoyed about that podcast, West Wing Weekly, was hearing Josh Molina talk about, because he's been in so many Sorkin projects, and talk about what it's like to be kind of one of his actors, like in the mix of his different projects.
I can imagine it might be, I don't know, I don't know if demanding is the right word. I'm reminded of, I heard an interview with David Mamet, and he was saying something very similar. He's of course, very careful about his words, and he can be a bit of a, I don't know, grump. Is that the right word to use to describe it? David Mamet, it's like actors are getting in the way of his script, seems to be his attitude.
Right. But you do need them
right.
in order to
it is a
have the words meet the audience.
It's supposed
There's
to
a
be a collaborative process.
A little collaboration. Right. So are you going to be able to have any sort of in-person launch event, a local kickoff in Roanoke, or what's your plan for the book release?
I'm planning stuff. I'm going to be doing a read in Philly. I did grad school in Philly, and so I have a lot of friends still up there, and I know a decent amount of writers up there. And that's going to be a lot of fun. That's going to be the day after the book comes out. That's going to be on December 8th. And as close to like a, you know, it's not quite my book launch because I'm reading with other very accomplished writers, so it's not like my show. But, you know, that will be, I think, you know, that's kind of the coming out party. And that's going to be live, and I'm very excited. I hosted a reading series here in Roanoke, which was so much fun to do, to get, you know, local writers out, and a lot of young people doing it for their first time, and their friends are there to see them, you know, and I tried to bring in faculty from the universities surrounding, you know, perspective. Writers that have achieved, you know, a good amount, and to watch them, you know, mix and talk, and it's a community event, it's a communal event, and I want to start it back up, but again, I don't know quite yet what safeguards to put in place, and you know how to bring it on, and by the same token, what's the appetite for that going to be?
You'll be in Philly. People can go up to Philly and see you in the Equinox Reading
Series.
Yes,
it's going to be at Fergie's Pub, which is a great spot.
Nice.
You should especially go on December.
Well, good luck. I will release this as close to your launch date as possible. We're not here just to talk about your book, although the book is the reason we've met. I'm so pleased. We're also here to talk about one of your favorite things. So, what are we here to talk about this evening?
Dreams. I love talking about dreams. I taught a class on dreams. I did.
Yeah.
And it was funny because I would have to explain, usually in the first class, that I am not here to discuss and analyze and interpret every student's dreams. Because I think that's why they mostly signed up. And many would express profound disappointment to me over the course of the semester that I was not there to analyze their dreams. But for me, the ties between dreaming, first off, and how just the mind works, but also the creative process and the interpretive process, you know, they're so intimately tied together, it might even be how the interpretive process began. We dream, animals dream. Every, you know, things dream, conscious things dream. There are debates now, can we do AI without dreaming? What would that look like? Would they have dreams anyway? I mean, that's just stuff that you know, current neurobiologists sort of batting around, but you know, for us now.
Like that, as we build AI systems, are we building systems that will dream?
Is it?
Oof. Small question.
Is it natural feedback from the process, right? And maybe it is. Or if we can't, if dreams don't happen, then you know, are they considered really conscious? I don't know. But
yeah,
everybody dreams. Everybody dreams, and everyone's dreams are so suggestive and sometimes beautiful and sometimes horrifying and sometimes intriguing, and we remember them. And dreams that we had 20 years ago, we remember. And I can't remember if it was Nietzsche or Freud who said that we're all an artist when we dream. And in that way, we're all sort of in this process of crafting and creating for the sake of what? You know, and that's another sort of question to lay on top that I think comes intimately from dreaming.
When did dreams for you go from something you have at night to something you have at night and you're paying special attention to? Like, when does it actually go from like a passive to active interest?
Yeah,
I don't know. Is that a sentence?
I think I can glean your meaning.
Okay.
My brain for the longest time was split between the academic and the creative. And I had a ton of interest in the academic. I got a PhD in literature. And in the course of my studies, I was really drawn to psychoanalytic criticism. And once you start to dig around in that, the question of dreams is in the forefront. And the way that the process of analysis by which, you know, we're talking about Freud here, but we could you know, go further back. But the process of analysis that comes around dreams mirrors, I think, to a large degree, the process of analysis that was already in place to work through, say, biblical texts. And it's began to guide, really, the process of critical reading through the 20th century. So I had to study these dreams, that are given in sort of the classic texts, and then study the process by which, and scare quotes, meaning was gleaned from these dreams. And once I started to do that, it started to affect my own dreaming. I think that the mind is very plastic. It is suggestible. When I would read one particular theorist, I would start having dreams that would match up with the theories of that theorist. And then I'd read another theorist who would have mm-hmm. dramatically different interpretations, and I started having dreams that would match those things.
Right. Right out of college, I worked at Fort Lewis College in Durango, Colorado. And one of the group therapies offered by the college was dream therapy. And I was a hall director, so I was student affairs staff. And I get to campus and everybody's like, first thing you got to do, sign up for dream therapy. And that was where I got introduced to like the personal interpretation. This is when I got out of the group what your students were looking for, which is like, you know, you explain a dream and then you say, like, we were in like a Jungian framework. But I absolutely still have dreams that we discussed in that I still think about a lot of things, but that's one from that time where I think about like how, like, I had this incredible disconnect between my work and my public face and like who I was. And it really came out in that one image. But it was, I did it for 2 years and I found it really helpful, a really great way to get to know people, but also just helpful.
Yeah, I think there's a, this is not something that, let's say, analysts argue about necessarily, I don't think, but it's definitely something that scientists are really worthwhile question as to whether or not, and it's something that,
right,
sometimes the point is moot and so, and you believe the dream means something. That's almost the most important thing,
mm-hmm.
is your belief in the meaning of the dream. And because, for instance, scientists like Hobson will point out that the difference between the waking mind and mm-hmm. the dreaming mind is that different systems in the brain
right.
are shut or, you know, amplified or turned down or whatever. So when you are dreaming, your motory skills are very low and your emotion is very high and your logic is very low. And so the things that are running through your mind while all those systems are doing something different, you know, why did I look at, I don't know, a colander and cry? What does the colander mean? And so something crossed your mind when you had this spike of emotion. And I think there's mm-hmm. some truth in that. But I also think that to say that there are no messages in dreams, I think is it's sort of a willful ignorance.
Right.
Right. On the other side of rational, logical processes, I begin to someone
right.
who might find that frightening.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good reason to just dismiss them all together.
when you had the feeling. So when you set up your syllabus for your class on dreams, which was not dream therapy and not dream interpretation, what were the sorts of things that you walked your students through? Like, are you starting with like Joseph, and are you starting with biblical texts and coming through and looking at it in that way? Or are you saying start a dream journal and turn it into literature?
Sometimes I did that, but I would start with Joseph.
Yeah.
And we talk about, his interpretation of the, of Pharaoh's dream and what that made Joseph in relationship to God, because for so long, dreams are messages. They are, but they're messages from what, from whence, is all the way up through. And, you know, certainly even today, God is the one talking to you through your dream. And if we can understand the dream, we can understand God. We can understand what God wants from us. We can understand what God is trying to tell us. And we can even have a closer relationship to God, because the dream is where he speaks. And then that changes. You know, that changes as God becomes increasingly less important, certainly in European culture. And so by the time we get to Freud, God is not outside. God is inside. It is the unconscious that's speaking to us. But in both cases, the dream is the conveyor of truth. Either God has the truth and he's telling us through the dream, or the unconscious has the truth of what we want and who we are, and it communicates that to us through the dream. There is something, and you know, the interesting Freudian spin is that there is something in you that knows who you are more than you do. And you need to let that speak or try to understand it. But really, it's just an internalization of the divinity that would be pulling the strings of the dream, you know, through time immemorial. The interesting thing about Jung, and I have gone through tons of Jungian texts to try to find something condensed where he explains how a dream works, because I really want to teach Jung. I think so much of what we understand about creativity and such is gleaned from Jungian ideas, and I think Jung holds a lot more cachet now, certainly, than Freud does, for a lot of different reasons. But the thing that fascinated me about Jung was the Red Book. Have you ever heard about the Red Book?
It rings a bell, but I can't remember what it is.
So this came out. It was a personal journal of his.
Okay.
And it came out, it was published finally when I started teaching this dream class, probably in like 2011 or something like that. And Jung had a mental breakdown, really because of good Dr. Freud, who threw him out of the psychoanalytic establishment because they had a big debate really about whether or not sexuality was the key to the human
psyche.
Freud said yes, Jung said no. Freud said, I'm so sorry, you have to leave. So Jung was sort of cast out and had really no prospects anymore. He couldn't practice psychoanalysis because that was a Freudian thing. And that, and combined with a lot of other things, led to this mental breakdown that went on for years. And what he started doing was he started, because he was having visions and hearing voices and all these sorts of things. And so he started to record them. And he recorded them in this huge book. It's like a massive... It's probably 2 or 3 feet wide. And so he started drawing everything he was seeing and writing down almost in a sort of cartoon fashion the things they were saying. And he was first doing it. He had no plan as to what it was. He just needed to get these things out.
He had to get it out.
Yes. But as it continued, it began to form a narrative. And he began to realize that it was a sort of classical quest narrative. And through the course of composing this book, he sort of wrote himself back to sanity. And so what he sort of believed had happened was that his breakdown had accessed this overstory, this sort of, you know, uber story that was at the center, not just of his consciousness, because he didn't, I don't think he believed that this was his unconscious doing something to him. He believed that there was something much greater, which is why all of the iconographic figures that he was coming up with and that were speaking, or rather we're speaking to him, have, you know, ancillaries to a very rich history of folklore and myth. But they finally published it in 2011. It was kept on his estate under lock and key. And, I think you can buy one now. They're several hundred dollars, but they're gorgeous.
Yeah.
They're absolutely gorgeous.
I just did a Google image search for it.
Gorgeous.
Just to get a hint of it. Because I was doing, I was in this dream group in 99 to 2001. So, like, this book wasn't available. So I also think it's would be really interesting to hear people who did Jungian dream interpretation or worked from his framework before this was published how that has changed.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I wonder if I can get a hold of Colin, who ran our group.
I was going to say it feeds into the notion of, because Jung wasn't necessarily writing his dreams, he was writing his delusions, right? But the question of what is psychosis like, you know, is it like being, is it like dreaming while you're awake? That's, you know, one gloss that's been put on it. I don't know if that's still necessarily, if that holds value or not. But it sort of goes back to a bigger question, which is one of sort of our perception. What is our perception doing? What is it for? If, I can't remember what book it was, maybe the Four Agreements, something like that. There was one line out of it that that jumped out at me, which was that you're not asleep when you're dreaming. You're conscious when you're dreaming. It's just a different kind of consciousness. And to follow, let's say, I don't know, like what Hobson says, that it might be to some degree the truth insofar as your systems of perception are doing different things in this phase versus another phase. But what are these systems of perceptions for, right? That's to say that when we're awake, we're seeing what's true and what's accurate. And that's not the case at all.
Yeah.
You know, the reason we perceive things is so we can move through reality and not die. Right? But I was thinking that, like, in a dream, you don't have to worry about that. You can die in a dream. And you can come back in a dream, right?
Right.
You can do more in a dream. Maybe that's what dreams are for. Maybe it's an unfettered expression of something that we might call consciousness.
It's been a while since I've really thought about dreams so much. It's so interesting. And because that framework I was given was just, you know, you would ask yourself, what's the, essentially that Jungian interpretation was everything in the dream is you. And if your dad is in your dream, if your teacher is in your dream, how did they make you feel? What was the emotion? And then, like, what in your waking life carries that emotion for you? And that was sort of like on one foot. How we would do it was, it was, okay, everything you interacted with was you, but, like, look at what are the emotions that you can carve out of it. Where have you felt that emotion recently in your waking life? And what is that that you're trying to work through there? Or because it was in the, it was in the context of therapy. So it wasn't in the context of literature or universal consciousness. It was very, you know, everybody was like 18 to 23 years old. It was very
still
very self-centered in a universal conscious sort of way.
Yeah, the I was in therapy where I was talking to a therapist, and it was I think he was Jungian based. I think at some point he told me he was, and I had a dream where I had a series of dreams. They were, you know, beginning to be annoying, where I kept seeing this person from my past in these dreams, and it was an ex-girlfriend.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to talk to her anymore, but she kept showing up in the dream.
Right.
He said this fascinating thing. He said, and it, you know, coming out of Jung, it makes a ton of sense. He said, she is your feminine manifestation of yourself, which is why she's there. And I was like, and that hit me really hard. This is one of the things about analysis. It's almost like the question of whether or not it's right or wrong is beside the point. The point is that does it resonate? And if it right. resonates, yes. And if it doesn't resonate, mm-hmm. no. Unless it really doesn't resonate, and at that point,
keep
that's a yes.
Keep going.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yes.
Just come back right around the circle to yes, and it's right. called denial. And try again.
You would dismiss my interpretation because that's part of your psychic makeup, right? The therapist is always on the right side. But so that what he said resonated, and I was like, "What do I do?" And he said, "Next time you see her, go up and tell her that you're sorry." And I was like, "Okay."
In the dream or in real life?
In the dream.
Okay. The
dream. Yeah. And I did. And I went up to her, and she was talking to a group of friends, and I remember I tapped her on the shoulder, and she turned around, and I said, "I'm sorry." And she just turned back around, and I was like, "Huh, okay. I guess that worked." And then, you know, the dream went on or whatever. And then I stopped dreaming about her.
Huh.
For 6 months. But I will say that when she did come back, she's gone now, God bless her. When she did come back, the valence was a lot less, right?
Mm-hmm.
The intensity was much lower. It was just a character, you know,
yeah.
in the dream. It had been disconnected from what it had been.
Yeah. What are other exercises you have your students do or that you do when you're diving in? Let me rewrite this question. Do you have a dream practice?
Oh, I don't. Easy answer is no.
Okay.
What I do think, and where the dream class went was we would begin to look at poetry mm-hmm. and to try to understand, and it certainly doesn't work, you know, for all poetry, but to try to understand poems in the same way that we would try to understand dreams, in the same way to try to understand where's the emotion here and what word encapsulates it and how did we get here? And assume that nothing in the poem is a mistake. Assume that mm-hmm. everything in the poem is working towards the incitement of an emotion. Mm-hmm. Where is the poem calm? Where is the poem, you know, where does it peak? And how does it end? You know, various dream interpretations will have very strong feelings as to why a dream ends and how a dream ends. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Can we use those ideas to understand a poem? And then from that, we can start to build out towards literature more generally. Poems are great. They're short.
Mm-hmm.
If you just give them to students and don't tell them what it, quote unquote, means, let them. So often they come up with things much better
mm-hmm.
than what maybe I would walk in with, right? But poems are also, they're drawing from...
Right.
They're drawing from classical literature as well. They're making allusions to things that are outside and that can, you know, begin to pull on Jungian pieces. I remember, I don't know if you ever read Black Elk Speaks. Did you ever read that book?
Mm-mm.
It is...
No. Great book.
Black Elk was a... he had been at the Battle of Little Bighorn. And he... Gosh.
Oh, definitely...
I really should know the details.
This book was in my house growing up. This is a very... I've seen this cover 100 times.
Yeah, yeah. It's a beautiful yeah. book. It's an interview with him. I believe it's in the first person. Of him talking about the history of the nation and
mm-hmm.
you know, when the settlers came out and things like this. But because he's a shaman, there's a lot about his visions. And one of his mm-hmm. visions, and it's this monstrous vision, it's thousands. And they move to the north and they do a thing. And they move to the west and they do a thing. And they move to the south and they do a thing. And then they move to the northwest and do another thing. And move the and it's this massive rotating thing. And I would read it and read it, and I'm like, what the hell is he doing? went back into Jung, and when Jung talks about a mandala and how the dream is a process of making this figure, then I could look at Black. I was like, this is a mandala that he's mm-hmm. making. This is the vision. The vision is of an object, right? And one of the funny things that, you know, I just sort of thought of this is Freud's first classic dream, the dream of Irma's injection, it's called, mm-hmm. in which there's this woman that won't speak to him properly, her and all these things.
It's that to cure dream, himself, perhaps, well, and not you, her? Fix his attitude towards her?
Yeah, well, this is Freud now. His attitude is fine.
Right. No, he's perfect. My bad.
Yeah, of course. You know, the critiques of this, and people have been critiquing this dream for 100 years, and they're endlessly fascinating. But one of the best ones I ever read was to analyze the structure of the dream. Freud has a vision right at the end of the dream of a chemical compound. That is central to the meaning of the dream. And he sees it, like he sees the chemicals sort of laid out mm-hmm. before him. And so this guy did analysis of the dream, and he said, if you look at the structure of the dream, as to if you understand the characters in the dream as elements in the compound, they're forming the same pattern.
Mm.
Which is the same sort of thing.
Right.
The dream is presenting almost a physical object, right? For the sake of what? For the sake of what? For the sake yeah. of, I don't know. Because again, what knows that object?
Yeah.
Right? Where does the dream mm-hmm. come from? What's speaking to you?
Mm. So you found just a thin vein of I can't think of what the word is. So my sarcasm just drops flat. just like out of my brain. You've really by, I think, applying dream analysis and these different frameworks to literature, I think it's a really powerful way to turn it over. In my synagogue, one of the things my rabbi will say when he's giving a sermon is he'll say devar acher, another interpretation, like we turn things over. So I think it gives you this really interesting way of, you know, because I was a chemistry undergrad, I've wound up in marketing, and so somehow I skirted major literature courses as an adult, and I consider myself a reader, and I have, you know, books of poetry, and I still find poetry kind of inaccessible. But I do think, like, putting a dream analysis framework on it makes it immediately more accessible to me.
Yeah, the one of the definitions that I've read of poetry, one that sticks with me, you know, I don't think there's a way to define poetry, but one of the definitions is what a poem does is it is able to manipulate syntax in such a way that it delays the logical part of the brain from processing what the poem's saying. But the more, or rather less rational processes when you read it are being activated so that you get the emotion of the message before you understand what the message is.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you never understand what the message is. You can work on a poem to unlock it and to be like, oh, that's what it's saying. But that, and there's poetry that works that way. I think of like John Ashbery, for instance. I think you get more out of the analysis than you do of the poem. But he wants the poem to do that, and that's fine. That's
right.
A school and a style. But for me, logical thinking about it and just allow sort of my emotions to read the poem. You know? The topic of the day. The dream works mm-hmm. because it feels like something. You know? If you went to sleep and just had like messages like emails, could you imagine how terrible that would be?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you wouldn't want to go to sleep. There'd be no mystery. There'd be no interest, right?
Miserable. A miserable night.
But I think as I have begun to, as right. I've done really more creative writing in the last 10 years, the thing that's fascinated me about dreams, and you know, because I'm doing more creative writing, this is what my mind does now when I sleep, is that it starts to, it's not quite, instead of this, what if this happened? Why don't we try it this way? Or why don't we try it this way? And I find that when I'm mm-hmm. writing or editing, I'm doing it well when I'm not thinking about it, right? When I'm just playing, when I'm doing, when my brain is doing something else and it's operating on maybe this, maybe that. Does this feel good? Does that feel good? And the question of whether or not it feels good, I think is intimately tied to dreaming. What's going to make the dream go? What's mm-hmm. going to make the dream more interesting? What if I said this? What if I went here? Now, there's a fine line for me when I'm dreaming, where if I try to do something, the dream falls apart. The dream feels intentional. The magic goes out of the dream, and it's just me.
If right? you try to take too much control.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And that's less interesting. But I think the notion of play that can happen within a dream, I think, is directly relatable to what's happening when writing's going well. Mm. You know, a lot of times, if a scene's really working, it feels like a daydream. Yeah. You know, it feels like a scene that I'm not consciously controlling, but one that's, you know, sort of moving through me in a way that I think would only probably be relatable to something like a dream.
Hmm. Do you want people to be able to find you on the internet?
I do. Let's see. Best place to find me probably is, I talk about the writing on Facebook, which is, I believe, cameron.mckenzie.7.
All right. I will make sure to link to that.
Please do. I have a website, which is cameronmckenzie.org. And that's where you can find the books and buy the books and read the reviews and short stories as well. I think some of them are linked up there, the ones that have been published online. But it's also where I update the events. I will be book signing in Roanoke in January, and then there's another reading outside of D.C., readings on the Pike. But yeah, all that stuff is on cameronmckenzie.org.
Great. And River Stories is available on December 7th.
River Weather.
River Weather. What did I just completely skipped a word. River Weather is available on December 7th.
Yes. Coming out on December 7th.
And you'll celebrate with a live event in Philly, which people should come out to.
Please do. I'm looking forward to it.
This has been great. Thank you so much for joining me.
Leah, this has been great. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.